This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Fargo Season 5, Episodes 1 and 2 are over, but we are just getting started here on Post Show Recaps, and we are here officially returning episodic coverage of Fargo on FX, FX on Hulu, just Hulu. I'm not sure. We're using Disney songs in this show, so clearly it's under that giant umbrella. Mike Bloom here, ready to break down a long in the making return to Fargo. Last we saw, erstwhile we should say, we saw this show. It was November of 2020, very much a different time and place, quite literally on the show. But now we are in 2019, back in Minnesota, ready to break down the quirky crime anthology comic drama series that has truly taken FX by storm since it debuted almost 10 years ago. Now, of course, I am not alone. Fargo always contains a voluminous, lovely ensemble cast of who's who. And you're probably asking, who's who on this panel talking about Fargo this season? I'm very excited. First off, she may not be American, but considering she's from Canada, she probably knows the definition of Minnesota nice more than any of us here. Grace Leader, how you doing?
I'm good. Do you mind if I just recap Blue Buds instead? Is that fine?
I mean, listen, is that another procedural show that's on in the Leader House as much as Chicago Fire is?
I think so. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Blue Bloods. We love, actually. Yeah. My dad loves Blue Bloods. So yeah, it is. Yeah.
It comes with the territory. And we are so excited to welcome in a third here as well. Someone that can be a Midwest representative here, considering that she is a nice paragon of that area of the country, though I'm sure she's a far distance away from Fargo, both in tone and in distance as well. Really excited to welcome to the podcast LaTanya Starks as well.
Hi, everybody. How's it going?
Now, what's the delivery on that hello? Because we know Minnesota nice may not be always Minnesota nice. Is there some pointiness beneath that?
Of course, always.
Now I don't know how to read that either.
You've got that's one of the things that you learn being a Midwesterner is being completely unreadable in everything that you say and do.
Well, I'm excited for us to take a big old read into this pulp fiction, I should say, that is Fargo. Again, the hit FX series that is based originally back in the day when the first season first aired on the hit Coen Brothers film from the early 90s, has very much spun off into its own thing on its fifth season, an anthology series that features, despite it taking place in the same universe, different groups of people dealing in the relative same region of the country, quote unquote, true people, real life stories, and oftentimes things spin wildly out of control almost immediately. Before we get into anything Fargo season 5, obviously there's a big history of the show, both in the show proper as well as the movie that came before it. I would love to hear from each of one of us, what is our Fargo origin story? Grace, we'll start with you.
Yeah, I watched the movie a while ago, and then I did enjoy it, and then but I feel like season one of Fargo is just one of my favorite seasons of TV ever. I think it's like so good. I think it's perfect. I think as a singular season of TV, I think that subsequent seasons, I've liked every season of Fargo, but I don't know that any of them have hit the highs of season one. I will say that, just a little tease, I thought that the first episode of the season actually gets maybe the closest. So I'm quite excited by this. But I just think it is the combo of like how dark these things can be, the stories that they're telling, mixed in with like the niceties of a North Dakotan accent, is just a tremendous sort of, these two things up against each other is a delight, a treat. I love it. I love Fargo.
LaTanya, what about you?
I love Fargo so much. I saw the movie when it came out originally, and just wanted the relationship that John Carroll Lynch and Frances McDormand had.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that that was absolutely adorable, and like wanted to be Frances McDormand. And then, like, along with Grace, when they announced that there was going to be a Fargo TV series, I was really excited. Didn't really know about Noah Hawley at the time, but loved seasons one and two so much. I've seen every single season. It's like appointment viewing for me. So I'm really excited to be here talking about it with the two of you. I love this show and have just like quoted this show a ridiculous amount of times in my life. Yeah, so I'm excited to be here talking about it. And I really, really love the first two episodes of this season. I think that they've got a really good cast. There are a lot of cast members that I don't necessarily recognize from other things, but Juno Temple's great.
Yeah, absolutely. And look at her making her way across the pond or across the Great Lakes, if you will. Martin Freeman in it, as it were. So for me, I want to say a late comer. I definitely didn't watch season one as it was airing. I was actually a very big latecomer to the movie proper. It did come out when I was 7 years old. So I was not like LaTanya in the theaters watching it unless my parents had a certain mind about what I should be checking out. And so I watched the first season, I think shortly before the second one came out. I watched that one live. You know, I did do some coverage of it here on post-show recaps. It almost lost me a little bit. I think Fargo is really interesting in that the odd number seasons almost always seem to be like original flavor, Minnesota, you know, cops and robbers type of stuff. And then seasons two and four, the even number seasons so far, they kind of just go off the rails. They're oftentimes throwbacks. Season two takes place in the 70s. Season four takes place in the 50s. They bring in wackadoo stuff like, I don't know, aliens and poltergeists. So it's so interesting to see, at least so far, season five maybe go back to its roots. I did cover season three in Absolute over on the Jane Jack Network. And then I don't think I watched season four live. In fact, I recently watched or rewatched season four because I honestly do not remember if I had watched season four in the moment. It was November 2020. A lot was happening. But I did really enjoy, I agree, these first two episodes. This just feels like a very distinct cast and a very distinct tone that they're taking. And I mean, this will be the most recently set season of Fargo. 2019. Yeah. And now that this is going to be a commentary, I imagine, on sort of like the post-Trump, pre-Biden world that the United States was kind of embroiled in during those 4 years. We already see that kind of represented in at least a couple of different characters. So I'll be intrigued to see, much like the time it seems to be a character in all of these seasons so far, how much that's going to have a bearing on this season as well.
Yeah. I thoroughly enjoyed the first two episodes. Like, it is fun to think of it. They go a little modern. I do think that's like, I like season four. I actually liked it a fair bit. I don't think it's as good as, I think it's definitely the worst season of the four that had come out at the time. I do think there is something nice about these like anthology shows that cropped up since sort of, you know, I feel like American Horror Story, but also like True Detective is coming back in a little bit. There is like sort of like this time period over the last 10-ish years where we've done, there's like a lot of anthology stuff that has come out. And I do think the sweet spot is that, like, yeah, I know not everybody loved last season, but I do feel like people could jump in to this one and watch Juno Temple and John Hamm like chew up some scenery for the court 10 episodes. I think this season is it might be 8. I can't quite remember. And you don't really, it seems like you don't really need to know what happened last season. I do think that's sort of like a testament to the style that they've gone in. It's kind of fun. Yeah. They're going to play in a more modern time period than we've ever been over the course of 5 seasons of Fargo.
Yeah, so we are going to be breaking it down. And indeed, Grace, it is 10 episodes. We are running this thing through the holidays into 2024. The series will actually, a season, I should say, will finish in January 16th, 2024, 3 months before the 10-year anniversary of the series premiering in the first place. So time just disappears from us all. I'm sure these 10 weeks will go by in a snap, especially because they dropped two at once. LT, thoughts about this? This is obviously something we've talked about a lot, especially covering Star Wars with their choice to drop multiple episodes at once. You feel like this necessitated the two-episode drop?
Not necessarily. We were talking a little bit before the podcast about how we didn't necessarily know if we needed to have two episodes here. I would have been fine with just the one episode and then the mystery of what this whole season was about and why the inciting incidents occurred in the first place to be drawn out a little more. But I'm also always happy when I get to just sit back and like let the next episode of a season play of TV. Because everything should be bingeable, in my opinion.
There we go. Hot take to serve up with your stuff in this Thanksgiving.
Yeah, that's the hottest take that I plan on dropping this Thanksgiving, actually.
I mean, I said this on a couple podcasts. Everything can be bingeable. You just have to wait for it to not.
I know.
That's the ultimate marshmallow test, you know?
Yeah.
Well, you don't have to wait long to listen to our coverage, at least. We'll be coming to you weekly. I think we're going to be dropping these probably Thursdays. I would say the episodes air late. This is not despite it dropping on Hulu, it's not dropping beginning of the day, right? We're actually doing actual broadcast airing late night on Tuesday.
Yeah, 10 p.m. I believe is the start time for the show. So 10 p.m. Start time. So yeah, if we're able to get together even if we get together on Wednesday, it might not drop in your feed until Thursdays. I go back and forth on this because on one hand, I feel very much like this is going to be, you already name dropped Star Wars, Mike. So I'm gonna feel fine. When in the middle of the Book of Boba Fett, there's like Mandalorian episodes, and I feel like on one hand, like I shouldn't care at all because I'm like, oh well, the Mandalorian, my favorite Star Wars character, is like in the TV show that I was watching anyway, and now I get like extra Mandalorian content. Like I really shouldn't care, but it pretty actively made me mad. From like, I'm like, why is this in this show? Like, why did we call this the Book of Boba Fett and the Mandalorian episodes are in here? To the point where I'm feeling the same thing about this. We're like, yes, I did get to watch two episodes of one of my favorite TV shows, Fargo. I did get to watch them, but also like, I think the best storytelling technique was to end this after episode one. I think episode one is full of it's episode one is so good. I think it's one of the best things I've seen on TV all year. And I think it's so good because they just drop you in. And as these things are happening aesthetically, it's like, you know, when the man at the back window shows up, like terrifying.
Yes.
And this all happens and there's a mystery element to it, but you're also suspicious of everything that's happening. Like, why is this happening? The way that she's just running, she's not running to the cops, she's running past the cops. There's so much in there that I was so excited for. And then they were like, and here's why that happened. Basically, like not totally, but like enough that I was a little bit annoyed to be like, oh man, I would have loved to sit in that for a week. And again, I tried really hard here on like post-show recaps. Like, I think we're trying to move towards a model of like, there are ways in which we wish shows were like dropped and released, and then there's the way they actually happen, and trying to just like be okay with the fact that like Hulu is going to drop two episodes or FX or whatever and just be okay with that. But I was like, oh man, that's so annoying. I would have loved to like theorize on that for a full week. And instead it came about 15 minutes after I was like first thinking about it. So, you know,
I'll counter your point with your own argument. You could have just, were it not for this podcast, waited 3 or so days, make it be the midpoint between your week where you could still theorize. I think for me, and again, I'll keep going back to the Star Wars example. I remember when we covered Obi-Wan Kenobi, it was this idea of they dropped two episodes at once. And the first episode was just like purely introduction. And then episode two really felt like, okay, this is what the series is going to feel like. This is what I'm assuming is kind of happening with Fargo, even though unlike that, this is in its fifth season and we're going to have a general taste as to what Fargo is going to be like, no matter what the characters are. The first episode, I agree, was like pretty damn sensational, but it was in part because it was such a contained story. And I think episode two, they really wanted to deliver on like, let's really explain who nearly everyone in this ensemble is up to this point, in particular, you know, who is Sheriff Tillman and his son Gator, who showed up in like, what, 2 seconds of footage in episode one. And so I could see if the bosses feel like, A, we want to make sure that, you know, we get an introduction to all of our ensemble, and so we have to drop two episodes to do it. And also B, it's a long weekend holiday in the U.S., so let's give them as much content as possible to get them excited.
Yeah, totally fair. I mean, yeah, John Hamm not really being in the episode one makes a lot of sense. But I loved what the way he is in episode one. I thought it was so intriguing. Mm-hmm. And then basically like find out. It's so funny because and to the point I made earlier about any show can be a bingeable show. You only ever get like to your point about like I could have waited if I wasn't podcasting about the show. I absolutely could have waited like 2 days to watch episode two. But actually, most people will probably end up watching the season of TV in a way in which like they'll actually watch like maybe three or four of these episodes at a time. And then the next day and like, you know, binge in a weekend when the show's over. So there's only, you know, the idea of weekly releases, I do love them, but I also right. think like I'm fighting an uphill battle because not only are a lot of streaming models moving or even TV shows, right? Moving to, I think what we did in The Shadows was doing this where they were dropping like multiple episodes the first week, like this, like dump a bunch at the beginning to get people hooked. Is like not a bad idea. I think it does make sense. Like if you watch the first one and then you might dip out as opposed to like, oh, I've watched like two, like maybe, you know, maybe I'll keep watching. You know, I don't know. I have that a little bit where I'm like, oh, I've watched six of them. Should I watch? I should probably watch the last four. So, you know, anyway. So I know that I'm shouting into a void and nobody cares, but I was like, it was the only thing about this whole thing that made me actively mad.
Episode one was so good though, that it would have kept, I think, people hooked and waiting for the next episode.
I agree.
Like I was clutching my pillows the whole time. Just it was so intense.
Yeah.
It was great.
Well, let's get into it because suffice it to say, as you both have mentioned, there is a lot. So let us start as we tend to do on post-show recaps with, in this case, a not so quick plot recap of episodes 1 and 2 of Fargo season 5.
I was gonna say, I've seen a lot longer plot recaps, Mike. So yeah.
There we go. And listen, it's containing what amounts to like an hour and 40 minutes into one entire contained thing. So, you know, it's a nice recap of the goodness that we experienced. Here we go. Dot Lion has a very bad day. She nearly avoids being kidnapped after lighting a man's face on fire and slicing off a man's ear with an ice skate, but is ultimately captured. When the truck taking her is pulled over, she escapes during a shootout between the kidnappers and the cops. Another showdown occurs at a gas station where Deputy Farr is shot in the leg. Dot manages to kill one of the men and take down the other, but both the kidnapper and Dot end up fleeing the scene. Dot returns home and says she wasn't abducted. Dot's husband Wayne lets his mother know about her kidnapping. She wasn't fond of Dot before, but when she learns that Dot has returned home, she suspects that it may have been a ploy to extract a ransom from her mother-in-law. However, it was Roy Tillman, the sheriff and husband of Dot, who sent the man after her. He tries to tie up the loose end of old Mulch, but the man outmaneuvers his son Gator and escapes. Later, Mulch will kill Gator's partner and leave a cryptic note that reads, "You owe me." Sheriff Roy is also being investigated by the FBI for failing to enforce the laws of the land, but Roy insists he is the law of the land, and his pierced nipples show it. Dot and Scotty booby trap their home. Dot explains that it's at the school board meeting that has made her want to protect her family. Wayne doesn't fully understand, but eventually relents, even offering to buy a gun. And that is just the first bullet in the chamber when it comes to Fargo season 5. There's, of course, much like a perilous lake, a lot lying underneath the surface. There's a lot to get into, but I suppose we should start with the woman of the hour and 40 minutes. Let's get into her. Juno Temple as Dot Lion, the woman at the center of this all, where perhaps to people's chagrin, we find out a bit more about her in episode 2. But it seems like LaTanya, she is like simultaneously the MacGuffin, but also a sentient character in and of herself.
Yeah, it's great how they did that. She is fantastic in this role. Just from the very beginning, we see her sitting there with her daughter in the middle of all that chaos, the fight that breaks out at the school board meeting, which is hilarious in and of itself. But, you know, she's just so scared. And who knew that she had a taser the whole time?
It's really fun. There's a line at the end of episode 2 where we didn't mention the plot recap, which we could write together. Mike, you read it out. And I realized, like, yeah, we don't really address the opening scene, which is the school board meeting where there's a fight already happening. Mr. Abernathy, the math teacher, gets tased and then a cop gets tased just in the frenzy of Dot trying to escape.
Don't chase me, bro. What does he say to her? Like the math teacher's like, I feel very alone right now.
Yeah. But at the end of episode 2, Because Wayne doesn't know that much about what happened, just that she got arrested, that she tased a police officer. And so he knows that. And then so they're talking about why she wants to booby trap the house. He's like, I don't know, Mr. Abernathy could come in and want revenge. He's like, you also tased the math teacher? Like, it's so funny.
It's so good.
I do think that's like I think that she is very funny. I think she's one of the more interesting characters I've seen on TV in a while, where she does have this inciting incident at the beginning where she gets arrested. That's how she meets Indira, I believe, is the name of the of the deputy. Yeah. And then being attacked, and you wonder whether it's like something that's happened in the tent, like because of the school board meeting. And no, we're going to learn it's like a much bigger thing than that, where she potentially is still married or was married to Roy Tillman. But the idea that she comes home, I love in television when a character is seemingly making like the worst choice possible, when it's like, you know, and this is sometimes can be very frustrating, but the fact that she's coming home and just being like, no, I wasn't abducted. And like in the world of the show, everyone's like, no, you were clearly abducted. Like, you know, like even her husband doesn't believe her, but her husband is going along with it because she wants him to believe it. She keeps like pushing him to be like, I just had a bad day. But they're like, we found multiple people's blood in your homes and none of it is yours. Like, you were clearly like attacked. I think this is so fascinating about why she does not want to reveal that she was attacked. I think it's so fascinating.
Yeah. I mean, this character is one of the most enigmatic characters I think we've seen since like Lorne Malvo back in the first season, especially a main character, because from what we're able to piece together, she was part of Roy Tillman's, I don't know, toxic masculinity cult, it seems. We'll talk more about his entire deal later on. She escaped from under him. And I don't know if she went into witness protection or just like hid her identity and has been living this entire other life as this like stay-at-home mom, typical Minnesota housewife.
I feel like she's both Lorne Malvo and Lester Nygaard. She's like both of them combined into one character.
But then the interesting thing is that like this entire thing is a take on the Lester Nygaard thing. Lorraine even suggests that, right? Like, oh, maybe the kidnapping was staged so that they could get money out of her. And so I love that callback as well to not only the movie, but the first season, which was like, again, kind of like a loose remake of the film proper. But what I adore about her is like, she is so cunning. She is so crafty. She is so incredibly smart. Like, her instincts are just absolutely rapid fire, considering that I would imagine from her perspective, she has not, quote unquote, done this, had to be in fight or flight mode for nearly a decade, basically the age of her daughter. But as soon as this creepy ass man in a kilt and a sack over his head casually slides open the back door, she's able to make a makeshift flamethrower. She's, you know,
the yarn is brilliant. The yarn, I think that's like a ploy, right? To like lure them up where like she can then use her thing. It's smart. So smart.
Yeah, she's playing dead to kick him in the face with an ice skate. Even when she's like cornered in the gas station, she's able to basically, you know what she is? She's a grown up Kevin McAllister.
I have in my notes, I have that they are home aloneing their house.
Even down to the sledgehammer.
And in the gas station as well. Like, she throws ice on the floor so that when the burn guy, you know, gets ice in the face, he slips on it and cracks his head. She is so incredibly wise beyond obviously everything you would expect from the surface. And it's bad to say, I'm really going to enjoy getting to see her crack, you know, in the one scene she has with Lorraine where like she looks around to make sure her daughter is listening and just tears into her, basically being like, you do not know what I have been through. I'm excited because we have seen Lester Nygaard being a great example, Peggy Blomquist, which was Kirsten Dunst's character in the second season, of like, good people go bad. This is an example, Latanya, of a bad person going good.
Yeah, for sure. And you know, it's just really nice to see Juno Temple like outmaneuver these people in the ways that she does. She's like even good at first aid. Like, she tends to Lamorne's his wound and everything. The scene that she has with her mother-in-law is really, really interesting because, you know, we've seen her do all of these things that you wouldn't expect this like tiny woman to be able to pull off. But then you kind of get that she's coming from a place where she's had to endure so much that she's not going to let anything stand in the way of what she has now with her family, especially with her daughter. And we get the call back to the Bisquick, like longest commercial for Bisquick that I've ever seen.
Which has more, you know, fingers in the pockets of Fargo, Bisquick or Kia this season?
Probably Bisquick. I mean, we got like close up in her like making the pancakes when she returns to the house, and we get to see the batter in all its glory and everything. So
that's true. We do close an episode on that, though. We do have a giant ass Kia logo at one point because Wayne works at a Kia dealership.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Koreans make cars now.
I think I love that idea of like, this is a bad person who's gone good. And I feel like I'm like totally, you were talking about like seeing her break. I'm excited to put her in more like awful situations and see how she figures her way out of it. I think the other side of this too is we obviously do have a couple characters. I feel like Fargo is pretty notorious for the pretty friendly police officer, right? That's like a big part of obviously the first movie. You have Colin Hanks in season one.
Carrie Coon in season three, memorably.
Yeah. And I think like they're doing it to a degree again. Although I do believe that her partner has maybe the worst Fargo accent on the show. Poor Lucas Cage. I love Lucas Cage. That was rough. That's really rough. I love Lucas Cage. And
yeah, he's great.
Oh, buddy, you know, but I do feel like, yes, we are getting, you know, and the Morn's character, I think Farr is Deputy Farr is his name. But then we're also getting like the big bad seemingly here is like the sheriff. I know like not from Fargo, right? He's over. Is that or there?
He's in North Dakota. Yeah. So when they're able, so basically they drive her over state lines bring her back to Roy Tillman. And that's when the entire brouhaha happens with Deputy Farr. So his jurisdiction is in North Dakota.
Got it. So yeah, even they're the North Dakota police sheriff here being the one who's seemingly the head of the big bad of the thing is an interesting, as opposed to our more notorious sort of like happy-go-lucky caught in the crime spree of something that's happening in Fargo type character.
Yeah. I will say to the point about, you know, Scotty and the fact that she is a stay-at-home mom, like the love she has for her daughter is so paramount. And also from our perspective, like she is such a caring mom as well, like knows that she loves silver dollar pancakes, takes her out for Dairy Queen. Like it's clear that she has invested so much of her life in her daughter. And I would imagine that the idea of like breaking that up, ripping that apart, and assumingly in the future, if and when, you know, Scotty gets put into danger, as she said, LaTanya, that's when that mama lion's gonna let her pride show.
Yeah, for sure. And we get callbacks to her thinking about her daughter, even when she's away from her. We get the idea that the motivation for everything that she's doing is her daughter. And how much she loves her and wants to keep like a normal life for her. This little girl though has like had her life turned upside down in the span of a couple days. She sees her mom arrested and then has to get whisked off to a neighbor's house because her mom has been kidnapped. So yeah, she deserves a little Dairy Queen, I think.
I love Scotty. F her grandmother for being like
calling her a
cross-dresser and like all of this.
But also Lorraine doesn't know what a ninja is. So like to say she's off is an understatement.
Yeah, but F her for real. But any chance that Scotty is John Hamm's daughter, that is not.
Oh, that's interesting. Because I was going to say, is there a chance that Gator is Dot's son?
Oh, interesting.
Oh, wow.
I don't know.
I mean, I don't know. We've seen John Hamm before play like a cult leader who took in child brides. Like, there's a
There's 3 years apart in age, Joe Keery.
Listen, you play one cult leader.
Yeah, but Joe Keery's also been playing like an 18-year-old for 10 years. So maybe my mind got a bit jumbled up.
That's fair. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I will also say as well, I love that the inciting incident, to your point, Grace, dropped us in the middle of it. I love the use of I've seen all good people, especially with the definition of Minnesota Nice, and just, again, the pure slow motion havoc of just a fight broken out and Dot obviously trying to avoid the violence, you know, just shielding Scotty that entire time. But violence always seems to find her, as we see here. And Fargo, from the movie to the show, has always been based in just a series of unfortunate coincidences happening to put people in the wrong time in the wrong place. And indeed, because she just happens to tase somebody out of abject fear, she's arrested, which puts her fingerprints on file, which gets her on the radar of Roy Tillman, which causes this entire thing to snowball.
It's real. The sort of like just the immediacy of the like how far it escalated in this episode, I think is like what was so good about it, to the point where I think that like was a little bit of a disservice to episode two in terms of like we're much more in a slow pace. But I think to TV shows, I've been talking about this a lot, do a really good job of like sometimes actually the premiere of shows are actually like super slow, and the first few are like they like. I think there's this like idea of like ramping up to a finale. It feels to be like a way that a lot of modern showrunners are telling their stories. This is like not, this was like no full tilt at episode one. And then we'll like kind of like put on the brakes and then let's like ramp back up in a way that I'm like very, very excited for.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
Well, listen, every, you know, anti-hero, villain, whatever you want to say, in Fargo must have like a nice seeming spouse by their side, whether it be like a Jesse Plemons, for example, in season two. Here we have Wayne, the husband of Dodd, very much set between his wife and his mother, being batted back and forth like a ping pong ball, played by David Risedale. LaTanya, give me your thoughts about Wayne, who is perhaps like the most Fargo of these Fargo characters this season.
Yeah, like total vanilla trust fund baby with an overbearing mom who just wants to play hockey in his socks with Scotty.
And watch Real Housewives.
And watch Real Housewives, yes.
Moment of me for the episode and Blue Bloods might have been when he says, like, he tries to defend his wife, and then she says, Lorraine says, Danish, can you slap him?
Yes.
Yeah. My and son needs slapped to be him hard.
Oh, this poor man. This poor man comes home and there's a sledgehammer above the door. Like, this guy.
I mean, listen, this poor man, if I may levy a bold prediction,
yes.
I think he'll be put out of his misery soon enough.
No.
I do not. Wayne is too good seeming.
He's too nice
to last the entirety of the season.
And everyone else in the season is a wolf. So, you know,
I hope not.
I think it has to be. I think these like incredibly, there's nothing wrong with him. And we have had characters like Molly Salverson and Colin Hanks' character that have been on that as well. But those have been like main characters, and Wayne to me seems very a little bit corollary to everything that's happening. There certainly have been scenes without him and Dot, but I gotta imagine in what's to come with Roy Tillman raining hell down upon her, Wayne's gotta be collateral damage.
I mean, and make it really obvious when they put him in a red shirt in every single scene.
I didn't notice that. That's very funny.
That's not true. Oh.
Yeah, he wore a big target on the back of his jacket.
Yeah, seriously.
His mom just you know, there isn't one lion I would like to see die, which is Lorraine Lyon. Please, if she could be dead as soon as possible, that'd be great.
So let's talk about her, not to move on too much from Wayne too much, but I feel like it's tough to talk about him not in the same breath as his mother, Lorraine Lyon, played by Jennifer Jason Leigh. And this is something very fun, LaTanya, because we have for the first time in Fargo someone bring in the Katharine Hepburn mid-Atlantic accent to the Midwest.
I was wondering the whole time, it's so Katharine Hepburn. I was like, why does she sound like this? Like, where is this woman from? Incredibly rich. Her house is huge. Enjoys making an entrance and posing in a Christmas card photo with giving everyone a giant gun. Like, what?
Oh my God, I forgot that that happened. I forgot that. Is the line of, honey, make a choice, when he's holding his whiskey glass and his gun is so good. It's so good.
It really is like a very evil, almost like more actively aggressive Lucille Bluth of just like so being so dispassionate about her family while simultaneously so venomous, containing so much wealth and power. She's connected to all the judges. She's having dinner with the attorney general right after taking this Christmas card photo. Obviously, like, besides the Tillmans, I would say she is one of the biggest villains, considering that if our protagonist is supposed to be Dot, she is the one that is most vehemently against her, consistently railing against her. And that's even before she suspects that, you know, this entire thing was hokey. But it's just so much fun. Jennifer Jason Leigh just like paints every syllable with such a dry rub. She is so funny. This might be my favorite character out of the first two episodes.
I mean, the fact that she, the train wreck that you can see coming, which is that she's sending this man, great name, I believe Austin in the Discord had flagged that Danish Graves, what is his name? Graves, by played by the wonderful Dave Foley.
Yeah, who I didn't recognize for a while. I think it was the eye patch and like the white hair for me. Because neither one of those things I usually think of Dave Foley having.
Yeah. So the fact that she's sending him, basically, like, they're gonna try and figure out what happened with this kidnapping, right? Like, I think they're gonna do litigation, but I presume like they're gonna want to see if they can like what they can peel behind, you know, what happened, and they're gonna run right into Roy Tillman's like gang of thugs, right? So it's like, this feels really bad for Danish Graves and Lorraine Lyon, but in a way that I actually like think is quite delightful, and actually might give like Dot some cover on like what's happening. It's like she has like the money and power to sort of like inadvertently actually shield Dot from what's happening, potentially what's coming for her.
LaTanya, we know Wayne will tell Dot this at the end of the episode, that Lorraine is seeking litigation against her, which to me feels a bit accelerated from her just like having a sneaking suspicion about something. How do you expect this to manifest in the coming episodes?
Yeah, that's really interesting. I don't know really how that's going to end up playing out. I can only imagine that it'll be kind of like something in the background that continues to play out, and we'll get a couple big scenes of it. But the idea of pursuing litigation against your daughter-in-law for trying to prove that like she wasn't kidnapped or tried to have herself kidnapped is ridiculous, and seems exactly like something that Jennifer Jason Leigh's character would do.
So let's dot off a couple of other Fargo, Minnesota characters before we move into North Dakota. But we mentioned her before. Risha Merjani from Never Have I Ever plays our, to your point before, kind of requisite cop with a good heart, you know, even if her bosses are saying that she's cuckoo for going down this line of questioning. She's got really good investigative skills, and she'll use it to bring the bad person in the form of Indira Olmsted. As we found out, she's shacked up with a wannabe pro golfer, I think, much to their financial detriment. It's surprising to me because, again, we talk about Molly Salverson. We talk about Gloria Bungle, I think was the name of the Carrie Coon character from season three. Both of them seemed incredibly front and center as both characters and like to the investigation proper in seasons one and three, respectively. And while Indira certainly has been at like multiple crime scenes, LaTanya, it feels to me, outside of the one scene at home, she actually has been fairly adjacent to a lot of stuff we got in these two episodes.
Yeah, I feel like she'll have a bigger role going forward, but so far we've just kind of seen her like happen upon these different crime scenes involving Juno Temple. And we see the incident that happens with the phone at the hospital when she's trying to get Lamorne's character to like identify Juno Temple's character, and the picture gets deleted. But I think that we're just supposed to get a rough snapshot of what her life is like, and kind of like the troubles that she's seeing, like her financial troubles, before making her maybe the like hero or heroine of this season. But not nearly as front and center as any of the other cops that we've seen in previous seasons of Fargo.
Yeah. Grace, any opinions about Indira?
No, I do think so. The last season comes out in the fall of the November 2020. Is that right? Like late 2020?
Yeah.
Is that right? I do think like they probably would have already filmed it, but the idea of like pushing the comp character to the back actually, I think makes some sense in the modern landscape that like she could be in there and she's a part of it, but to make her sort of like the endearing like protagonist almost of the show, I think makes some sense, especially for like a show, even if it's set just a little bit before all of everything that happened in 2020, obviously.
Oh, you think the season's gonna end with COVID?
I was thinking actually about the George Floyd protests actually, but yes,
Roy Tillman dies of COVID.
could be. We are not that far out, right? We're
very close.
Yeah, we're like Halloween, right?
Yeah.
Halloween.
I don't think so. I think we're gonna end a nice Christmas scene and be like, and who knew what happens after that?
2020 is nothing but up right now.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Oh my god, I didn't even think about that. Yeah, and also so filming for this season started in October 2022. So I could definitely see that as well, though they certainly had a perspective in mind. And not to say that Fargo is like a propaganda show, especially compared to something like the aforementioned Blue Bloods, but I would imagine they want to bring some nuance into like not necessarily needing to like put the police force front and center. And I think we'll get into obviously with the Tillmans, as you mentioned before, very much showing the other side of the coin of what happens when people have absolute power to, you know, adjudicate over the law.
Yeah. And this idea, like, not to, like, again, they're like, Roy is very much like seemingly our antagonist of the show and is a law enforcement officer. And so not actually have like trying to be like, okay, that here's we're going to like have this character. And also we're trying to show you the other side, just kind of like highlighting John Hamm's character, I think makes some sense, but I don't know.
All right, well, let's hop state borders over to North Dakota. And we'll save, you know, the Tillmans for last here because I want to dote on the person in North Dakota who we do see first in the form of Whit Farr, played by Winnie the Bish himself, Lamorne Morris. This is another officer. This is a North Dakota state trooper who also happens to be at the wrong place at the wrong time. He stops the kidnapping of Dot, ends up getting besieged at a gas station in the process, makes friends with Dot in the moment, or at least they work together to escape that hairy situation. And I'm assuming is going to work together with Indira here to try to, for lack of a better term, connect the dots and figure out exactly what's been happening. LaTanya, any thoughts about Whit Farr? I mean, obviously he was involved in the most climactic sequence of these two episodes.
Mm-hmm. Really does kind of personify, as you said, wrong place at the wrong time. Ends up having to run away from these two assailants and ends up getting shot. There's no weapons of any kind at this place other than air horns, which we all saw the effectiveness of.
The air horn. This episode was so funny.
So good. And I thought for a second, okay, this might be Chekhov's air horn. We're like, maybe they blast it in the ear of old Mulch and then maybe that'll deafen him. But no, it was the most weak-ass air horn ever.
he just blows it and gets shot. It's so
he
funny.
He just immediately gets shot. It's and so he doesn't funny. Even, Mulch doesn't even turn around to shoot him. He's just like an afterthought.
So good.
He does get to be in like the most climactic scene of the episode. So tense, like such a great thriller setting. And then the lights go off and it starts to descend into a horror movie. Really, really great stuff to watch. But it's interesting, like what will end up happening with his character, because I think he really just wants to solve the mystery of who this woman is, who kind of came out of nowhere, went from being a kidnapping victim to actually helping him to escape with his life.
Yeah, I thought that between the scene where like Mulch first shows up at Dot's house, and then the scene where Whit is just looking out into the darkness to see if he can, and then he gets shot, or like those are the most horrifying things. That's honestly my worst fear is like, we used to at my house have a giant back, like not a giant, but like a glass window that like when it's dark out, it's like, they can only see me. I can't see anybody out there. And it like terrified me as a very young kid. So this like basically happening, like someone at the window, and then like that was in daylight, but then the scene where he's like looking out and then he gets shot, I was like, that's terrifying. And maybe also stupid on Whit's part, but I do kind of love that he's not the most like you know, efficient cop. Like, he's not the most professional. Like, she's clearly like going, like, he is. He's like, is there a back door? It's like, no. And then she's like, he's like, he tells her that, but then she's like, oh, but there'll be a bathroom window, which yeah. then she just like booby traps, right? Because she knows that like they're gonna try to get in. So yeah, I just think he's fun. I'm excited. He is like in there, but he's very much passive in the scene as everything's happening, and we'll see how much he gets like looped back into everything. He's obviously on the Minnesota, no, he's in the North Dakota side. He's a state trooper, yeah. right?
But so, I believe yeah. that Indira goes to visit him, which makes me believe that, like, because Gator also visits him, so that makes me believe he was like hospitalized in Minnesota. I'm not sure how they like found him, and I guess I don't know. I haven't traveled between those states. I don't know how much of a hop, skip, and a jump it is between these two areas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it sounds like he's a North Dakota state trooper. So yeah, but if he's like, you know, monitors the border. Anyway, yeah, we'll see.
No. Well, let's talk about the man who put that bullet in Witt's leg. Of course, it is Fargo. So we've got to have this like mercenary assassin who talks in riddles.
Yeah.
And in this case, it is Ole Mulch, played by
Is he
Sam.
Mulch? He might be Munch. He might be Munch. I might have gotten his name wrong. He might
oh,
be
Munch.
Munch.
And Munch, Mulch, his partner's Mulch, that's for sure. After he got his face burned off and then uh-huh. smashed on a toilet seat. So LT is like, because Munch was so silent throughout the first part, terrifyingly,
yes.
of the first episode. We hear him talk a lot more in the second episode.
Mm-hmm.
Is his quirk that he like talks in the third person? He says, this person likes this. This person would want this. Or, oh no, he says, sorry, a man would want like this man. Likes
a man.
This.
Yeah. A man would need. Yeah. He speaks really, really in like on a weird kind of cadence. And he's even called the Riddler at one point during the episode by Joe Keery's character. I'm not sure what's more terrifying, the riddles or the silence.
Yeah.
He's just a really off-putting character. Like, I guess I learned in watching the first episode that my biggest nightmare is someone showing up in like a Zodiac mask and a kilt. Because he just really struck like a terrifying, like stranger style home invasion, horror movie, like stance, when he came into, Dot's home. But yeah, I don't know why he talks that way. Like, it's a really weird character quirk.
It's Fargo. That's the answer. It's like yeah. anyone who is an assassin has to have this weird personality trait about them, Grace.
I assumed he had some sort of accent. Does he not have an accent? Does he not have...
So Sam Spruell is European. British. So I do believe he probably, like, if he was trying to hide an accent, I would not be surprised if he was having trouble hiding it. He could be an international assassin. I don't know what resources Roy Tillman has.
Yeah. The thing I love about him is the take on like there have been these sort of like henchmen-y type figures and he fits it perfectly, but now we're kind of playing with this trope that he's actually not like the bad guy trying to like track someone down. He's like getting revenge on the people who hired him in the first place. Is pretty fun. He's very much like Grimm's Shredder for the first movie, and then some of the other like henchmen-y type characters we've had over the course of the show. It's kind of a fun play on it.
Yeah, like definitely a less loquacious Lauren Malvo as an example, but even like from that first season, Mr. Numbers and Mr. Wrench were kind of, especially from the personality quirk side, were definitely in here as well as like kind of the neutral party, the agent of chaos that will go wherever their money is. And obviously the big axe to grind that Munch has is where his money is going, which should be in his pockets. In the opening of episode 2, he's very pissed about the situation that he was brought into. He said that he thought he was kidnapping a housewife, not a tiger. And as a result, they welch on him. They take him out back and they try to shoot him. And what I love about Munch is here is this like kind of lumbering, slower, older man, but almost like John Wick style. He's able to come out of retirement still and like take multiple of these young strapping guys with guns by storm, like easily take down Gator in multiple ways. And now I'm assuming taunt him, LaTanya, for the next little bit of time of just like, give me what I am owed.
Yeah. It's a huge flex to be able to just leave a dead body with a note and a knife sticking out of it, you know?
Well, when you're distracted by spicy jerky like that, you know?
It's really spicy.
It's really spicy.
he's going to be an interesting character going forward because, you know, we never know. We might get a team up between him and Juno Temple, and that would be interesting to see.
Yeah, we have a lot of like pieces in the bowl in the mix that like I don't know how they're all going to interact with each other, right? Because you have like Roy and Gator, you have like Mulch or Munch like chasing them. You're going to have like Lorraine and Graves like looking into all of this that's happening. Like there's a lot of pieces that they like kind of just put into the mix. And like you said earlier, Mike, like it's kind of one of the shows where like a lot of stuff like sometimes happens to people by sort of accident. But there's a lot of ways in which like a lot of miscommunication can happen here and things happening to the wrong people because they're all like looking into each other.
Yeah. The enemy of my enemy is my friend is like a main edict, I would say, of Fargo, especially right. with multiple sides. This is not a game of chess. It's more so a game of Chinese checkers where there are multiple sides. And like, depending on where you end up at that portion of time, who knows? Maybe the woman is going to work with the man whose ear she cut off with an ice skate at a certain point. Who's to say? Strange bedfellows.
Can I just shout? Austin had posted also in the Discord chat, which I thought was great, is that how good Fargo is at like taking mundane objects and then making them like such a, they're like these memorable things from the show. Like
yeah,
I'd seen.
Scraper.
Yeah, the ice scraper, the ice skate, obviously here as like it's this thing she uses. Like Fargo is really good at this, of like the mundane objects that also get like tossed into the mix and uses these like these things that are so symbolic of the show.
Yeah, I would say one of Ewan McGregor's characters, one of the twins, was I think killed by like a stamp or like a stamp behind a piece of glass or something. Right. So giving objects power. Well, let's finish with two guys that probably would compare a certain gender to objects. Let's talk about the Tillmans here. Mm-hmm. Let's start with let's save the best for last. Let's start with Tillman the younger here, as here is Joe Keery. And after all that goodwill of the past, like four seasons of Stranger Things saying like Steve Harrington's not a bad guy, you know, Joe Keery's so sympathetic, LaTanya, that all goes right out the window with freaking Gator Tillman, who is just like an absolute asshole.
Gator. Just absolutely. What a ridiculous character. Like everything about him is just like incompetence personified. And he... Like, he doesn't even, it takes him forever to notice that his own partner is, like, laying by the car dead because he's just so concerned with his jerky and Mountain Dew. Like, I don't know how you go from Steve Harrington to this character, but he's managed to do it, and I'm going to enjoy really disliking him for the rest of the season, I think.
Yeah, Nepo Deputy is pretty fun.
Deputy.
Yeah, it's very fun. I like it. I think Joe Keery is very good fit for like the, you know, he's like the beginning Steve Harrington where we were not like totally yet endeared to him.
That's true. Yeah.
So yeah, I'm excited for this. I think it could be really fun. He gets to share some scenes, obviously, with John Hamm. So that's fun. He's been the accidentally deleting the photo thing, which like is like so silly, but like whatever, it's fine. You know, he's just like saving time, doing whatever he can to like, you know, try to make sure that they get to Dot first. So he's kind of hateable, and I like it. Yeah.
Well, I think there's an interesting thematic that I'm assuming will resound throughout this season as well as to like what we impart to our children. Obviously, Scotty and Gator are of two very different ages, but like looking at how Dot and Wayne treat Scotty versus assumingly what Roy has instilled into Gator from birth. The first thing we hear Roy Tillman say is like, my father was a sheriff. My grandfather was a sheriff. Obviously, Gator is very much brought into the sheriff's department. So like, to see the values that he was brought up with versus the freedom, assumingly, that's been granted to Scotty. I will say, I think my favorite funny moment from these two episodes was Gator when they're visiting the hospital with Wit, and Wit says, you know, listen, it's my job, right? Protect and serve. And Gator says, I'm here to protect, but I ain't in the service industry. I'm into kicking ass and taking names business. And then he vapes in a hospital room.
In a hospital. Vaping in the hospital is very
so
good.
Good.
It's very much the idea, you know, we talk about John Hamm's character saying his dad and his dad before him. And so we get the idea that this is like very much a family business, them being sheriffs and being ranchers. But there's also the generational idea of when you get to like the youngest generation, it's just like, and they're just idiots and they're going to fumble the bag for like everything that they've inherited. And that's just kind of an idea that is like written into the show, which I think is really interesting.
Yeah, I do love that idea that like he looks, you know, so big with his bravado, has, you know, the half long hair, half shaved look, big arm tat, obviously like walking around in his sheriff's vest all the time to command his power. But not once, not twice in this second episode, he's caught flat footed. He gets won over both times by old Munch. Now Munch. I'm going to keep saying Munch.
I know. I'm so sorry.
It's Munch.
No, I kind of like calling him Mulch too. We'll switch on and off here.
I like it.
Old Robert Munch. This is the. Do you guys
That's
have Robert
what it
Munch?
Is. That's what yeah. it is. Mm-hmm. Keep mixing him up with that. Now let's finish things off with the man, the myth, the bear butt himself,
the hard man for hard times,
John Hamm as Roy frickin' Tillman. This is like the perfect mixture, in my opinion, of two of the things John Hamm does best, which is like the hard-lined, toxic masculine persona that was Don Draper brilliantly in Seven Seasons of Mad Men, and John Hamm being so freaking good at being funny.
Yeah.
Like, people didn't expect him when he showed up on 30 Rock and SNL and Kimmy Schmidt, but he is so good. He is one of my favorite comedic actors out there. Watch the Fletch reboot if you haven't yet. Nobody else did, but he's so freaking good in that. Thank you, LT.
I do think it's not even John Hamm. It's not Don Draper. He has moved into some of these, like on the morning show. He basically is playing like Elon Musk. Top Gun, he plays the he plays the Thorn and Maverick side. So he's settled quite into this, like the role of like the hard line, like a-hole kind of. But this one I do feel like will have much more of that like comedic element than I think a lot of his other ones have had. So that's fun.
He's ridiculous, Lasagna.
Terrible, terrible person. Like the little monologue that he gives in the diner right before asking for Huckleberry Pie and like choking a man. And then it's just like, go home, make a meal. And like whatever else he tells her to do.
Pray on it and forget this ever happened.
And also please him with your mouth.
It's just like, what doctrine of male like masculinity have you read or authored that you think any of this is life advice?
So I think one of the interesting things to flag is that there are three characters who talk about deals and the way in which like and what you owe Roy does it talking about, says, well, yeah, of course I wanted her back, like that's my wife, and that she made a vow to me. And then Lorraine talks about that, and then Dot herself talks about that, and that makes some sense if like that's the language that like Roy might have used, that like Dot might not like agree, but she's talking about how like, no, I'm upholding my end of the deal from when I married your son.
He views marriage as an investment, right? He talks about she's accrued interest from 9 to 10 years of being gone, and now I need to get that back.
So that's a big theme, is like what you owe people, and these like in the contracts and deals and things that you, the agreements that you make, and whether or not you're upholding that. I would like just flag it as I don't really know what that means, other than it might just be like, these are all people who like all know each other, and they're all like espousing some of the same, they don't all know each other. Like Lorraine and Roy obviously don't know each other, but they're espousing a lot of the same language. But I think it's very noticeable that it's like three characters are using this type of language over the course of the episode, that it has to be something that like, we're going to continue to like either, you know, play into the themes, or will become part of the plot, I think. Yeah.
Well, what I think is interesting is you look at those three characters, and they are, from my perspective, some of the most, quote, untouchable characters in the show. Right. Obviously, that is the entire conflict with Dot, is that everyone wants to get her, but they can't. Lorraine, due to just her high status and her connections, feels like she may take a tumble, but again, she is so well off that it's all talked about. Okay, let's get Dot in a better place because she knows so many people. And that obviously leads into Mr. and Mrs. J. Queen going to go see Tillman here, where they basically tell him like, what the hell are you doing? You're not following any laws. And he says, well, I'm following my law.
It's so funny. I'm the law of the land, and God told me, you know, it's like, oh my gosh, shut up.
I am the law. It's wonderful to see the FBI visit someone because they're not upholding the law.
Yeah, very funny. Yeah, very good. Like, yeah,
that's amazing. And he's just sitting in an outdoor hot tub the whole time with the other sequels.
Yes. The other piece is that Lorraine actively does not want the feds involved in everything that's happening. So that's another thing to just note, that like, as she's potentially looking into like Roy and the kid and the kidnapping thing to figure out like if it was a ploy by Dot, she also does not want the FBI involved in all of that stuff. So,
Mike, where are the post-show recap towels with our faces on them?
I know. This is the thing. You talk about, like, Tillman branding. I mean, it does feel like this town is Tillman Town, where he says his constituents believe in him. Yeah. We see a big-ass billboard of him with his face on it to start episode 2. And, yeah, perhaps the crux of that comes with when he is finally beckoned out of his hot tub, bare-ass gleaming in the cold North Dakotan air. He has a towel with his name on it. Like, he has merchandising.
So you obviously want that billboard to be somewhere where people drive, but I do love that he takes his horse to ride by the billboard, that presumably there's so little traffic that you can ride your horse out there. It's very funny.
He's like, yeah, I don't even need to put this up. You know, this is just be throwing money into the wind, but
it's just a reminder.
God has to build monuments for a reason. I love it. I think we'll hopefully get more of a glimpse into like the company that he keeps right now. It just seems like a bunch of generic white guys holding guns. But again, I would love to see if this truly is almost like a cult-like hold over the town. You know, we saw just a glimpse of these two people and how they view the sheriff, but does everyone in town feel that way? Is it more of a cult-like we love him thing, as he opines, or is it more of a dictator do as I say type of thing?
We shall see.
All right. Well, I want to finish things off, actually, with something fun that we'd like to do here on Post Show Recaps. A lot of blood likes to get spilled on Fargo. In fact, in the first episode, two types of blood. And did you hear the story about the
It was O negative and some other that I can't remember.
And a lot of blood was spilled during that one story that Dot says, where the guy walks into the hospital and walks out with an entirely different brain.
Yeah,
that's right.
You don't say.
Well, we're going to put our brains together. I think we should do a death draft. I think we have a good amount of characters introduced. I'm assuming more will probably come in the next batch of episodes, but I think we have enough. So I would say probably pick two characters each they don't need to be main characters. They could be recurring characters or ones that seem like they are named and have a significant role to play, but we'll go around the horn. We'll each pick, one character to die. We'll do two rounds and then we'll proceed from there. Do you all need some time? Do you want me to start?
No, I can do it. Would you like me to draft a
go ahead
a draft order?
Yeah. Go ahead, right. Grace.
Well, it looks like LT gets to go first, I think, because I drafted this. Yeah. And then you, Mike, and then me. And I'm assuming we'll snake draft it.
Yeah.
Okay. So you get first and last pick, LT. Yeah.
Wonderful. I'm gonna go with Lars Olmsted. Lucas Gage's character.
Okay.
He feels in there to be
He'll never get to play in the golf tournaments that he's sunk $2,500 into.
Why do you need that simulator? Like,
this wins your months.
Oh my God. You have no money. What are you doing?
Yeah, to get the image of her pouring over those overdue notices, I'm like, oh my God, they're really on such hard times. Cut to him with the virtual golf simulator. Really a tale of two different sides of that house.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, I already put my stake in poor Wayne. I think I'm going to permanently lease this Kia and park it in my garage.
Wow. All right. Wayne Lyon. I think that's smart, I think. I'm also going to go with somebody who's sort of ancillary to a main character. I think like we're all kind of hedging our bets a bit in terms of, you know, you're not going to take Dot, Mike, but you'll take her husband. Yeah. And LT, you won't take Indira, but you're going to take her partner in Lars. I will take the best named character on the show, Danish Graves. Dave Foley, I feel like, as Lorraine's attorney, potentially doing some digging for some dirt, might find himself in the mud and get got. I could definitely see that.
Yeah, and I think watching Danish be the one to visit Wayne at the car dealership, I think unfortunately means he will stick his neck out and sort of be that collateral damage. I'm thinking that when we see Lorraine, we only see her in her home, in Don Wayne's home, and in her office. I think she has made a lot of characters surround herself with security, quite literally in this.
She has a bodyguard.
Who might, if I had like a third pick, I might pick him. I feel like that guy is done.
Jerome, I think is his name. For my second pick in a row, I think there's a lot of people you could take. And I think that it's like, yeah, that makes sense to me. But I feel like the person I'm going to like say is the most obvious person to die of the people who are left. I'm going to take Ol' Munch. I think, oh. I don't think Ol' Munch comes out of this season being alive. Yeah. So I'll take Ol' Munch. Yeah.
I'm of a couple minds about what happens because Fargo, especially in like seasons 3 and 4, are not afraid to kill off its like main character.
It's a big cast. There's a lot of people in the show that I think like you killing off one of them, I think, is fair.
Yeah, but I feel like to your point, Grace, like between Roy Tillman and Lorraine Lyon, one of them is going to be like taken down by the feds and the other is going to die. And I really am just like flipping a coin, trying to figure it out. I will take Lorraine. I feel like we have seen the businessman get taken down before in the form of VM Varga in a season 3. I don't know if we're going to go in that territory again. So it makes me think that maybe Danish and Lorraine will be a 1-2 punch.
Yeah, I think that that's a good pick. I think I was tempted to take Lorraine as well.
All right, LaTanya, your last pick.
I'm going with Gator.
Yeah, Gator's a good pick.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Gator's gotta go.
Yeah.
All right. We'll see if we're going gator hunting for the rest of this season. 8 episodes left. Grace, any final thoughts about these 2 episodes? Any other details we want to touch upon before we depart?
No, it was so funny. I think but it was also so dark. That first episode is extremely dark in tone and nature, and the whole thing is like, I loved the dream sequence. We talked about how John Hamm was only kind of a little bit in the first episode, but Dot seeing Roy, mm-hmm. And then waking up, I thought was really effectively done as he's like praying at the dinner table or whatever. But yeah, I thought the tone was both incredibly dark and very funny. Is exactly what I like, kind of my favorite type of TV show. So I love that first episode. I thought episode 2 was good too, just not to the standards of episode 1. I'm very excited to watch 8 more of these as the weeks go by.
LT, any final thoughts or details we might have missed about episodes 1 and 2?
I just hope that the season goes in the direction of the tone of episode 1. It was just so thrilling and just like, you know, exciting to see what was going to happen next. And you're like holding your breath the whole time. So I'm enjoying what we got so far, and hoping that the season is as intense as that.
I'm personally looking forward to seeing like Scotty's tastes, because when Dot asks Wayne about like, is Scotty traumatized? He says, well, nothing, a little bit SpongeBob and some Game Boy couldn't fix. And I'm like, yeah. I wonder what era of SpongeBob is she watching? Why is he calling it a Game Boy when it's probably like a Nintendo 3DS at this point? Like, what exactly, how 2019 will we be? Is what will determine. I mean, we did have, you know, the accidental photo delete on the phone. So yeah, I guess we are, for the first time, really, Fargo's taking place like in the near 2020s. So we'll see how much technology has an impact on that. Well, we hope to have an impact on your podcast listening. As mentioned before, we're going to be back weekly. Some form of the three of us will be back talking through Fargo each and every week. Wednesdays, maybe Thursdays, recording after episodes drop late Tuesday night. Make sure you're subscribed. If you're a patron, you can get ad-free versions of this, as well as access to our Discord, where, as Grace mentioned, we are looking through as well, getting some feedback. You can talk with a lot of people that are also watching this show, as well as all the other shows we cover on post-show recaps, of which you can find us certainly on a good amount of them. LT, anything you want to plug from the post-show recaps end?
I don't have anything to plug right now, but we'll be working on some podcasts in the coming future.
Nice. Grace, what about you?
I'd be lying if I said I didn't have any podcasts.
Lion.
Yeah, it'd be Wayne Lyon. the Crown is back, so Shannon, Gus, and I are talking about that episodically, weekly for the first 4 episodes that got dropped. Push Your Caps Theater with Ariel. This week we talked about Hunger Games, The Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes. Yellowstone, Rich and I are talking about. I'm chatting about The Curse with Dr. Amanda. I think that's actually it for now. So yeah, I'm on social media at High From Grace.
Yeah, and I'm at a Mike Bloom type. I'm also covering Battlestar Galactica with Josh Wigler as we are nearing into a dash of episodes before a bit of a holiday break on our end. And I'm still doing a bunch of reality TV stuff with the CBS lineup over on Rob Has a Podcast as well. So that's going to do it for our coverage of Fargo, the first 2 episodes. Again, we'll be back weekly, continuing to see what madness will unfold either in Minnesota, North Dakota, or perhaps beyond. Thank you all so much for listening. Grace, LT, great work as per usual. Really looking forward to getting to talk weekly about this fantastic show. It is definitely off to a rip-roaring start, much like a lion proper. Thank you all again so much for listening. Take care. Goodbye.